Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly analysis of major economic events and trends, the forces, national, local, global, that shape our jobs, our incomes, our taxes, our debts, in short, the economic aspects of our lives. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life at several universities, and today I teach as the visiting professor at the Graduate Program for International Affairs of the New School University in New York City. I also write columns of economic analysis for the website truthout.org, a courageous source of independent news, news analysis, and commentary daily. If the kinds of discussions, reports, interviews, and so on that we have on this program interest you, let me also direct you to the two websites where we do more of this sort of thing and that are both available to you 24/7 at no charge. The first one is rdwolf with two F's.com, and the second one is democracyatwork.info. Not only do they have information and links and all sorts of useful material for you, but they also provide, both of them do, a way for you to communicate to us, to let us know what kinds of discussions you would like to see, what kinds of questions you'd like to have answered, and so on. We read each and every one of your emails. We ask you to understand that because we get so many, we can't answer all of them personally or on the air, but they are all read and they all help shape this program. So once again, if you're interested, rdwolf.com. With two F's.com and democracyatwork.info. And last of all, please remember to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. Okay, we have more updates today than we can possibly deal with, something that's been happening more and more. But before I get into them, I wanted to say two things. First, I want to honor the memory of Pete Seeger, who died this last week, and who shows us, for those of us that have followed his career for years, as I have, how it is possible to be an extraordinarily successful singer, folk singer, to be able to reach so many Americans, and yet also to be a courageous American, one who not only celebrates the wonderful things about this country, but who has also had the courage to point out where we can and should do better, to protest the injustices that exist, and yet all the way through to maintain the kind of spirit that makes all the rest of us proud that he was once among us. I also, before I do my updates, want to talk about a remarkable thing that happened in the last week in a place you might not have noticed, namely down in North Carolina, particularly in Asheville, North Carolina, where a significant and successful corporation by the name of, I want to get the name exactly right, used to be called LockTech International, and it's now called Plasticard LockTech International. It's a company that makes those little cards in hotels that allow you to get in and out of your room and in and out of the elevator without a key. 320 employees of this company that has grown over the years found themselves in a new situation. The company sold itself, it was a privately held company, to its employees, all 320 of them, so it became, by act of the existing private company, a worker-owned enterprise. And I think it's interesting that we see that. The company did a search trying to figure out who to sell itself to. It had several suitors who were other private capitalist companies of the usual sort. And it decided, rather than sell itself to these other companies who had whatever plans for whether or not the company would continue, whether it would stay in Asheville, North Carolina, and so on, and they decided it was too risky and not advantageous, and so that the best course of action for this corporation was to convert itself from a conventional capitalist enterprise with employers and employees who were different people into a worker-owned. It sold itself to its own employees. And how this will work is that over the next set of years, basically this company will become more and more owned by its own workers. There were all kinds of tax advantages to doing this. It's a long and complicated story. But what I wanted was to quote to you the statement made by Ron Leventhal, the founder and current CFO of this company, in explaining why they chose to sell themselves to their own workers. Quote, "Now the workers have the most direct ability to impact the success of the company, and now more than ever have a vested interest in doing so." In other words, this company hopes to become more competitive and more successful because it's giving its workers a direct ability to impact the success and a vested interest. I just want to leave you with one thought. If the workers get that benefit, and if the company gets that benefit from making workers owners, then you might want to think about the next step that we talk about on this program so much, namely, if the workers become the directors of the enterprise and not just the owners. In the plan at this company, the workers will be the owners, and the old board of directors stays there. But in the longer run, the next step, the logical next step, in the words of their own chief executives, is to go and become a worker self-directed enterprise as well. My next update, the first real one of today's set of them, has to do with a remarkable statement made by an executive of the Bristol-Myers Pharmaceutical Corporation. The chief executive there is Maureen Deckers, and he was reacting to a problem that drug companies are having, particularly in India. Merck is having the problem, Bristol-Myers is, and I wanted to tell you what it is. Under Indian law, if a pharmaceutical is priced too expensively and is needed by millions of their citizens in an urgent way at an affordable price, the Indian government, under its laws, has the right to provide what's called compulsory licensing. That allows the government to enable a local company to produce a patented product without the consent of the patent owner, who still owns the rights and receives payment for its use. This is actually something that the World Trade Organization has recognized. And in effect, these licenses can put pressure on brand name manufacturers to cut prices in response to expensive alternatives. And so, in a drug that was produced by the Bayer Corporation, its chief executive officer, Maureen Deckers, is the person in question. They're fighting to get an AIDS drug to be allowed to be produced in India under this law, and Bayer is opposed to it. And in the course of this struggle, the Bayer chief officer, Maureen Deckers, said the following, quote, "We did not develop this medicine for Indians. We developed it for Western patients who can afford it." Now, I don't have the time to go into the morality and ethics and finances of such a statement, but it will tell you how intense the struggle is over making pharmaceuticals affordable to the people who need them. The defense of the pharmaceutical industry is, and as it has been, that they need to be able to price things at these extraordinary high levels. This thing costs almost $100,000 a year in order to be profitable. And the answer to that has been that the pharmaceuticals have generated higher rates of profits for the last decades than most other sectors of Western economies. So that fight is being fought out, and I wanted to bring it to your attention because of the principle underlying what the Indian government is doing. Next, there was a release this last week about union membership in the United States. It stayed steady over the last year at 11.3% of the labor force. It is much higher in the public employee sector than it is in the private, as I think most of you know. 11.3 means that roughly 14.5 million Americans are members of trade unions working in the public or private sector. The trajectory is not good. There are falls in public employee unionization that do not bode well for the United States. And one interesting statistic was we learned, if we didn't know it before, which states have high rates of unionization and which low. New York State leads the 50 states with 24.4% of its labor force unionized. North Carolina is at the bottom with 3%, quite a range in unionization. When you look at these numbers overall, and you see that the last 50 years have been almost a straight decline in union membership in the United States, certain things become clear that I wanted to make sure you have in your mind. One, if less than 7% of the private sector employees are unionized, the next time you hear a corporate executive or a politician rail against the big, powerful unions, you need to ask yourself what planet exactly they live on. Unions are weak, have become weaker almost every year for 50 years, represent a very, very small percentage of the workforce, and have a social and political influence roughly comparable to the membership density that they point to and that they have to live with. It's also important then to understand that the reason particularly Republican politicians go after labor unions and have quite successfully in recent years, particularly in the public sector, a little footnote. In Wisconsin, public sector unionism was 53.4% in 2011 when the struggles led by Governor Walker began. In 2013, that had dropped from the 53.4% to 37.6% as the percentage of public sector unionization in that state. The reason Republicans go after the unions is not because they are a powerful social force, but because they are a force that contributes to their other opponent party, the Democratic Party. The union's relationship to the Democratic Party, funding the party to some extent and providing it with staff, is what the Republicans are after. It's not about their social influence directly in terms of struggles with employers in most cases. All of these statistics would lead one to expect and hope that the labor movement thinks about changing its long-term strategies, since whatever else they've accomplished, the decline in membership and influence is something that one would expect them to think about and change. Another update that I really cannot resist is the $20 million payout to Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan Chase. As I have stressed very often, this, which got a lot of attention, so I don't need to go over the details of it, this issue of paying executives highly is much more important in American media than I think it is or deserves to be. The problem we have is structural in our society. It has to do with the way our system works and is organized, and not with the relatively small, in the large picture, amounts of money, staggering as they are for individuals, that are the payouts to top executives. It's really not the issue, and it tends to distract people from the underlying systemic issues, just as the call to prosecute and imprison these folks does. It's not about whether that's a good or bad idea. It's about you're not going to change the system if you imprison or fine those at the top, since you've left in place all the rewards and punishments of the system that will govern the behavior of whoever replaces the person you fine or imprison or throw out of work. But nonetheless, having said all of that, there is something symbolically remarkable in a year when that corporation, J.P. Morgan Chase, had to pay record amounts of fines and admissions of what it was doing across the board in the foreign exchange market, in the LIBOR scandal, in inappropriate fees, in the mortgage debacle of the last few years, that the company saw fit to raise the salary of that fellow in the face of what is going on in the United States. One has to recognize that something symbolic and therefore important is involved. The last update, before I turn to my guest and a different kind of discussion, has to do with something that is getting more and more attention, even though it doesn't deserve it. This is a myth, and the myth is there is a return of manufacturing to the United States. That is not the case. There isn't a return, or let's put it differently, the big attention given to a handful of corporations that have made a decision to do manufacturing in America is a small drop in the bucket against what is actually happening historically. So just so everyone knows, manufacturing today produces 12% of the GDP of the United States and accounts for 9% of the total employment. in the United States. By one estimate of the Economic Policy Institute, over the last decade from 2001 to 2011, 3 million manufacturing jobs were reduced here in the United States. I want to stress that whatever the quote-unquote return is, the return of jobs to this country, manufacturing jobs, is, as I said, small. According to the New York Times, an article by Steve Rattner, some of you know because he had a great deal to do with the rescue, so-called, of the auto industry under Obama. On the 26th of January, the New York Times, he writes that since 2007, we've had a 12.5% loss of jobs in manufacturing, and this despite that there's been a 2.4% decrease in the real wages. So the wages of manufacturing workers have gone down, and instead of that leading to a growth of jobs to take advantage of the lower wages, in fact, we haven't had that. We've had a continuing loss of those jobs. And now the final kind of coup de grace of this whole discussion. Rattner points out, quite correctly, that we ought to compare the wages of jobs in the United States with those abroad in manufacturing to help us understand why this process isn't going to turn around anytime soon. Auto sector wages in the United States, over $45 an hour. By comparison, in Poland, $9.50 an hour. In Mexico, $7.80 an hour. In India, $2.10 an hour. In China, $4.10 an hour, all stacked against the $45 an hour in the United States. And last point. In the few examples, and I'm going to mention two, where manufacturing has been invested in by companies here in the United States, a further look at them. The first, General Electric, which opened a new plant in Louisville, Kentucky, over the last 2 or 3 years. Here's the thing to keep in mind. First, the bottom level wage, the mass wage offered in that job, $13.50 an hour, gets you $30,000 a year, barely above the poverty rate for a family that had to rely on that amount of money. And the other big example, Volkswagen in Chattanooga, Tennessee, the base rate was $14.50 an hour, even with benefits, $27 an hour. By the way, Volkswagen was interested in coming to Chattanooga to pay $27 a year with benefits because the comparable outlay in Germany is $67 an hour. But the key point about the jobs that were created in Louisville and in Chattanooga, Louisville, Kentucky, Chattanooga, Tennessee, was the amount of subsidy provided by those two states to get those jobs there. It worked out to $577 million in Chattanooga, and I thought you might be interested. That works out to $288,000 per job created. That's money that the government, the state government, used to bring manufacturing. And the question is, what else can it not do? And what will be the effect on the American economy when the only few jobs you get have to be financed by subsidies of that size? Well, I have many more updates. They'll have to wait. I want to turn now and welcome to our program Max Frod Wolf, somebody close to me, as you can probably guess, and a person who also teaches in the New School, the graduate program of international affairs at the New School University, and is also widely known as a person writing regular economic blogs both on the Huffington Post website and the Seeking Alpha website. Max, thank you very much for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay. The real topic for this conversation, and I have a set of questions, is to hear from you, a person who literally is paid both by as a teacher and a consultant and an advisor to keep track of the macro economy here in the United States. We hear a lot these days, we heard it again on the State of the Union message of the president, about economic recovery. Tell me what you think. Is there a economic recovery, and what is it, and for whom is it?
Sure. So we got three new data points across this week, this ending week of the month of January here. One is GDP running at 3.2%, which is better than had been expected, less of a rate than we thought coming in. We thought more like 4% the previous quarter. We also got new jobless claims on Thursday, and we also got durable goods. I think this sort of tells the story pretty well. The GDP number looks pretty good at first blush, but we have to remember that the most accommodative, or about the most accommodative monetary policy, with the Federal Reserve doing everything they can do to help, that means going from $800 billion balance sheet when the crisis began to a $4.1 trillion balance sheet this week. With them doing everything they can, with the government running near $1 trillion deficits, we're getting about 3% growth with all that help. So it's not bad, but it's not great. The other two data points are a little bit more alarming. So that would be the durable goods, and that's really things consumer buys that last more than 3 years. So a washing machine, at least you hope, right? A washing machine, a television, a stove, et cetera, right? So it varies a bit. And then we also got the new jobless claims. The new jobless claims are a big deal because they tell us how many people were added to the rolls of the unemployed. That actually popped up much more than was expected. We got that news this Thursday. The reason I would call you to that to tell you the story of the recovery is we also saw the Congress cut food stamps and refuse to extend unemployment insurance. So what we've had is a sideways labor market, weak in December, not showing great strength in January, and what we've decided to do in response to that is keep the stimulation up in the monetary markets, congratulate ourselves about a recovery, and true, things are better than they were, but also slash the social safety net for food and or emergency financial assistance to the people who need it. That's a perfect version of where we're at. Depending on where you sit, it can either look like a pretty darn good recovery or a pretty insulting discussion about recovery. And that really is the story of the bottom 80% of Americans for whom recovery is just an insulting thing they read in the newspaper, in the unlikely event they read the newspaper, whether they hear on the radio or see on the internet. And then the top 20% for whom they live it, they can feel it in their bones, and they really have had a recovery. Despite the recent swoon in the stock market, the broadest measure of equity prices is up about 150% off the trough in 2009, and 150% increase in your wealth would make you feel like a recovery pretty darn quick.
So give me a better idea. Let me follow up on that. Tell me more about, first, those who've been helped, those who've done well. Tell us a little bit about this stock market rise. How have individuals been affected by the rising stock market, and how have corporations participated in this recovery? And then we'll turn to those who are just the spectators of this.
Sure. Well, there's a lot of diversity here, from rural versus urban to Northeast versus Midwest versus Southeast versus West Coast, right? So a lot of differentiation. Part of what happens in economics is we like these tools of analysis that aggregate things, that shove things together, make us easier to sort of fetishize our measures. What's easy for us in writing a statistical report doesn't necessarily do a very good job of explaining the lived experience, right? So when I teach this in my class, I always say the following. The average American couple has 1.3 kids. It's a good warning about averages, because if you get caught with 0.3 kids in your house, you're going to go to jail, and you probably deserve to go to jail, right? So there are some problems here with averages. And those problems of averages get worse the more unequal a society is. So on average, we have recovered a bit. The problem is about half the total wealth or income in the United States or more goes to that top 20%. So if they're doing better, everything looks like it's doing better. So numbers aren't lying to you. It's just the problem. It's the 0.3 kids. Right? And to some extent, if you want to really push this analogy, the top 20% got the one kid, and the other 80% are sharing the 0.3 kids. Okay. And that's a little bit the story of the recovery.
Compare corporate profit. Have corporate profits recovered as well as stock prices? Or is that really not an important question because the same people in the end collect the money?
No, it's very important, and different industries have done different performance levels. Corporate profits have done incredibly well in two measures. The absolute measure, how much profit are we generating, record-breaking of late, and maybe more importantly to the discussion you're trying to have about distribution of wealth as opposed to just the quantum of wealth, the percentage of GDP, or what we call GDI, gross domestic income, that's gone to corporate profits has shattered every record we have. So we have no idea what those numbers were before the 1930s, but we know we've kept track pretty well for 80 years. In the 80-plus years we've kept track, corporations have never taken home this large a slice of the wealth, right? And what that means to the average person, right, is work isn't working very well. Wealth is working very well. The more your life is about having wealth, that's the best of jobs, serving wealth, or having proximity to wealth, which is gaining nicely, the better off you're probably doing. And the more your life is about income, particularly income in lower paid jobs or more fragile jobs, the more the recovery is something that probably just makes you feel worse about your poverty as you imagine other people are doing well.
Right. Okay. Wonderful. And last thing about those who are doing well, Give us some idea of the stock market from the time the crash hit, sort of late 2007, to the present. Give us an overview of what happened, who lost, who gained, a kind of a sense of how the stock markets function to reflect what you've been saying to us.
Sure. So last week I participated with NPR, National Public Radio, and we had roundtable discussions. Very good. Good questions. And they were really about how the market is celebrating the five-year anniversary of a five-year bull market. So basically, there's some dispute about when we should start this. In my opinion, the bull market really began in March 2009. There'll be other people who will tell you it's really February. It's not very important to anyone, and certainly probably not the most important issue to your average listener or viewer. But the point is, it's been about 5 years. In that 5 years, the stock market has basically gone up over 150%. Been a rough couple weeks here in January, but we're up still about 150% off that base. So if you had $1 million and you were working hard 5 years ago, your wages have gone up exactly nothing. But your income has gone from, your wealth has gone from $1 million to somewhere on the order of $2.5 million, right? And that tells a bit the story. So if you look at the average American employee adjusted for inflation, they're actually making a little bit less than they were 5 years ago and about the same or slightly less than they were 10 years ago, right? However, if you look at wealth, wealth is actually nicely up, particularly the last 5 years. But to be fair, that's off a very low base because the sort of financial world was in an advanced state of decline there in 2008 and 2009.
Right. So if your income is mostly about money from wealth, interest, dividends, capital gains, things like that, and we do know that a tiny percentage of the American people own the bulk of the shares and the forms of that, then there's the key explanation, in a sense, to the growing gap between rich and poor, that more than anything else, because you've told us that those dependent on wages are more or less where they've been over the last 10 years. So if we have a growing inequality, which every measure we know of basically says, then the explanation is the extraordinary increase in the returns to wealth, extraordinary gains made by those who already were wealthy in becoming that much more wealthy.
Sure. Well, I mean, the basic ways that we give opportunity to people so they can increase their lot in life materially and we push people ahead are incomes from work. That's the big one. And then the other huge one that we tend to forget and not discuss for cultural and political reasons in the United States is public goods and public services. And rather unfortunately and somewhat unusually in the United States, in the midst of a recession, we have slashed public employment. We have slashed public service provision. So we're disinvesting in roads. We're disinvesting in bridges. We're disinvesting in schools. So what we're doing is saying work isn't working, you're not getting a raise, and we're going to make it harder for you to get ahead in the future. Wealth is working, you are getting a raise, and you are going to get one in the future. And the good news is, if you're doing really well, you'll pay lower taxes. And the bad news is, if you need an even playing field, if you're young, and the young have done very badly in the last 5 to 10 years, you're really, really badly, then basically you're on your own. Good luck. Work hard, you might be the 1 in 100 who succeeds. And then we just sort of hope that everyone forgets that if 1 in 100 succeeds, it's a wonderful story. It is inspirational. It's a great part of the American culture. But it also has a dark side, which would be the 99 people who didn't.
Right. Last point before we take our mid-program break. Can you expand a moment on your point about young people? Tell us a little bit about their particular position in the story you've been evolving.
Well, it turns out, rather not so shockingly, that the youth in the United States are unbelievably burdened with student loans, right? If they went to college at all, even an associate's or a two-year program. Part of this is to do with the growing evidence of chicanery here in the private-for-profit ed space, which is really unsavory in many, not all firms all the time, but it is populated by an unduly large number of unsavory folks who figured out a way to suck up federal aid money in the form of student loans and basically give these people little or nothing, and they go on to not do well. Right? Right. So we have that problem, the student loan problem, which is $1 trillion growing fast. It is a national shame and a huge debilitating factor for a whole generation of people. So that's part of the story. But the truth is, it's very hard to climb the ladder if you're not allowed on the first rungs. Right? This is a story about racial bias historically, about gender bias, about sexual orientation bias in America, but increasingly it's a story about young people. If you came onto the labor market, if you went out and looked for a job, if your formidable career formation should have taken place between 2000 and 2014, and really particularly between 2007 and 2014, 7 years, you have been left behind in a structural way. And, you know, we hear all the reports. For some people, this means living in your parents' basement. For other people, it means having 3 jobs. For lots of people, it means they can't afford to get married. They can't afford to buy a home. They can't afford to have a child. They can't afford to go on vacation. And this has become an epidemic. So we're looking at a generation which not only is unambiguously going to be poorer than their parents, but has given up the hope of being as wealthy or wealthier than their parents, and are literally doing a mediocre job of trying to survive at whatever's left of the semblance of a middle-class life that they thought was their birthright, or that they thought they would get through hard work. And the wage numbers and the career numbers and the labor force participation numbers tell us that dream has faded for an awful lot of people in this generation.
Thank you, Max. We're going to take our short break at the middle of this program, as we always do. Please hang on. We're going to return with Max Wolf, economist, blogger, professor at the New School in New York. This conversation will continue. Please return with us in a couple of moments.
Once upon a time, long ago, there was a boy who lived on the banks of the Hudson River. In those days, he used to look out of his window and see the sailing ships, with their big white sails, sailing up the river, coming back from all around the world. One evening, he sat down to eat supper, and he said, "Ma, what's this mush for supper again?" She said, "Well, Sam, we don't have anything but mush. We can't afford chicken and nice things like that, like other people have." Well, Sam pushed his chair back from the table and said, "Ma, I'm tired of mush for breakfast, mush for lunch, mush for supper. I just don't feel like eating." And he shoved his chair back and he got up and he walked out of the house and he walked down to the river. He walked down to the beautiful river where the beautiful boats were. He listened to the sailors talking down there. And one of the sailors was singing a song. "'Tis advertised in Boston, New York, and Buffalo, 500 brave Americans a-whaling for to go, singing, blow, ye winds of the morning, blow, ye winds, hi-ho, clear away a running gear, and blow, blow, blow." Sam went over to an old sailor who was sitting there whittling, and he says, "Is that true? Do they want people to work on the whaling boats and sail around the world catching whales?" Sailor says, "Sure thing, son." He says, "If you want a job, you go over to the captain there." Sam went over to the boat. He said, "Captain, captain, you got a job for me? I'll do anything you want. I'll shine the doorknobs. I'll scrub the decks. I'll do anything you want. I'll peel the potatoes. I want to go with you. I want to go around the world. I want to catch whales." The captain says, "Well, now, son, it's hard work. Doesn't pay very much." "Oh, I still want to go. I want to go." "Well, son, you got your mother's permission? It's all right with me. We need a cabin boy." Sam ran home as fast as he could. "Ma, ma, pack my toothbrush. Pack an extra pair of pajamas. I got to go. I'm going to sail around the world." And his mother got a little bag.
Welcome back. This is Richard Wolf. The program is Economic Update. And I'm going to return to this interview we're having with Max Wolf, economist, blogger, and professor at the New School University in New York City. We've been discussing the recovery and how it has impacted some people quite nicely and the vast majority not so well, to say the least. Given all of this, with this display and the difference in impact, tell me, why is there so much talk about recovery? Why is it in the newspaper? Is it on the lips of our politicians? Who benefits from hyping this recovery if it has the reality you just depicted?
Well, partly it's our definition of recovery. So given the definition we work with, positive quarter after quarter of GDP growth, this is legitimately a recovery. Partially, it's the criteria looked at by the National Bureau of Economic Research, right? The NBER, which actually has the official duty. They have something called the Business Cycle Dating Committee, and they actually have the duty of telling us, okay, we were in a recession, now we're in a recovery. And so they've certainly signed off on the recovery thesis for several years now. That's part of the story. The other thing is there's a bit of social relief, particularly concentrated among the elites, which is reasonable, which is things really did look pretty darn dire going into 2008, 2009 there. And there was a sense, probably best described by folks saying that the world was kind of coming to an end. So there's a bit of relief, probably justified, that that's no longer the circumstance. Those are the kind of good reasons. The other quasi-good reason is we know that if people are frightened about the future, if they believe the economy is in bad shape, if they believe the future is daunting or frightening or likely to be unfortunate for them, they will do things that make the economy worse. They'll save more money. They'll be generally more down. They'll go out less. They'll be more frightened to buy things. If they're corporate or managerial class people, they will also hire fewer people. They'll be afraid to make investments in a new factory and hire the people or add employees. So the belief that things are bad will make them worse, right? I like this, the following phrase, all market prophecies are self-fulfilling because largely markets are group psychiatric dynamic, right? As opposed to rational engineering, as much as we like those models in economics, the group psychology models tend to be more accurate than the engineering models, even if they're less precise, right? So there is a reason to tell people a happy story. However, there's a risk, right? And we do tend to push it to the edge, or if not over, which is if you constantly tell people things are great or about to be great, they stop listening to you altogether if that isn't their lived experience. There's a bit of danger there, but we do have a tendency to do that. The other reason politicians talk about it and companies talk about the recovery is because they're telling you to buy more things. If they're, if they're a company, they're telling you to buy more of whatever they're selling. And if they're a politician, they're basically telling you they're doing a good job. Because one of the things we know for sure, right, left, center, right, Republican, Democrat, Independent, basically the public looks on the success or failure of politicians in many regards on what's the economy like? What's my future like? Do I have an okay job? Can I get a raise? Can my kids get a job? Can my parents get into proper medical care, et cetera, right? So you're basically telling people that you're doing a good job, which, while a little bit less than humble, is not exactly unusual.
But it's not exactly accurate, given what you've told us.
But you still want to tell that to people all the time anyway, because you're giving yourself a positive review in the effort to influence their sense of how well you're doing. Sure, it could be positive. Again, look, economy is a big patchwork. 315 million people in the United States, huge country, right, with vast differentiation, vast inequalities, and vastly different stories for different groups, different regions, different industries.
Well, Max, I want to ask you to do something that is relevant to you less as a professional economist, but more as a citizen of this country. But I want to put the two together by saying, let's have your opinion about a question that I think is on more and more people's minds in this country. As we watch the gap between wealth and poverty, or wealth and the middle class, as it is so often referred to in this country.
I like my own term for this, stole partly from Prince, the recording artist, which is I like to call the American middle class the artist formerly known as middle class, because we still have the understanding that we have a middle class, and obviously statistically there's always something in the middle, but we decreasingly have what I think is a real middle class. What made the middle class so strong, so vital, so empowered in the United States, in my opinion, were four pillars, which was the sort of expectation of a living and rising wage, the ability to retire, the ability to send your kids to school, and access to quality medical care. Probably home ownership should be in there too, so maybe five. And what I think the economy's done over the last 40 years is kick out one leg after another. With each crisis, one of these legs either gets kicked out, cracked, or shortened. And so we have a situation where, of course, we still have a middle class. Of course, we still have a larger middle class than many developing countries that are poorer. But our middle class is smaller, it's more fragile, and it's easier to drop out of into poverty every year than it was the year before.
Right. So here's my Here's then my question. In a society that has prided itself on a big middle class, that has justified all kinds of actions it's taken for the last century on the grounds of its commitment to a middle class that has all those legs and all those five legs in place, is it a sustainable political trajectory? Is our future as a nation going to look anything like what it's been for the last 50 years given what you've said? In other words, what is the meaning to our kind of a society with our kind of self-consciousness when the basis of a middle class is suffering the undermining you just so nicely summarized?
I think I would say something like the middle class is, being middle class is a little bit like what it means to be American. It changes over time, it's not exactly clear, and it's quite plastic. So if you look at American history, and you do look at some good research on this subject in American history, people have kind of thought they're middle class for vastly different reasons at different moments, and it's meant totally different things. Probably rooted in part of the idea that you could be a small farmer and get a plot of land here, possibly by killing some indigenous people and taking it from them, but hopefully through a little bit less nefarious of a route. And so there's this notion you can make it on your own. It's very much part of America's DNA. We'll always probably have some self-identification in that range. What the middle class actually means, though, grew up, the modern sensibility about it largely evolved between the 1930s and let's call it the early 1980s. That is dead, because that was built by a particular set of rules, regulations, and social institutions, which largely have either withered, died, or been crippled in the last 30 or 40 years. So the big middle class may still be an American sensibility, but this education, the health care, the retirement, the rising and sort of livable wage expectation haven't gone all that well. They were actually built by hard work and sacrifice by hundreds of thousands or actually millions of people. They could, of course, be rebuilt, but I don't see much out there that looks like that's happening. What I kind of see is a middle class that paid little or no attention to politics for a lot of reasons and just sort of felt like it's someone else's problem. I'm going to go to work. I'm going to work hard. I'm going to do what I'm supposed to. I'm going to save. And if you do those things, you succeed. So the people who don't didn't do them. There's something wrong with them. They chose to fail, or they just wouldn't do the hard work. And people work very hard to get that dream. And I think what's begun to happen, particularly again with the young, or folks who were traditionally, for all kinds of reasons of discrimination, et cetera, left out of the bargain. So it sort of grew from there, but I think it's now the sort of majority, or becoming the majority sensibility. But if you're not born wealthy or well-connected, you're either lucky or you're not going to have that kind of life. That means a little bit more to me. We have a 19th century style economy in the United States before the New Deal and the Great Depression and the Second World War. And so my guess is we're going to have a 19th century polity. You can't have the political system of a big, largely opportunity-rich middle class if you don't have the big, opportunity-rich middle class. You have more of an economy that goes to the highest bidder with a little bit of systemic corruption and a different sensibility. You could make no better argument that we're going in that direction than looking, for instance, at Citizens United, a court case that more or less auctions off the U.S. House and Senate, and with the incumbent results you might expect.
Yeah. Is that a sustainable, ideologically, given the formation, you're telling us that the middle class will continue, but what it means to be middle is sinking, and sinking relatively quickly, and forcing people to redefine middle class in a downward ratcheted series of steps. Is that something the American people, in your judgment, as a citizen, will they accept this?
They are accepting it.
Right?
So they're angry, and there'll be responses, and I certainly don't have a better crystal ball than the next woman or the next man out there. What I think is the middle class has been constantly reinvented. It's already in the process of being reinvented. And I do think that the middle class will be angry about it. I think we'll have a lot less political stability than we used to. Look, the bottom line is if you keep people with the chicken, the reason for the chicken in every pot and the car in every garage was to have an unusual lack of political unrest, an unusual lack of political discourse on the edge, the far right and the far left. I think that you can't do that, right? So you can't have the sort of vast, moderate stability politically if you don't have vast, moderate stability economically. They kind of do have to march together. Having abandoned the vast opportunity for the middle class economically, I think that folks who think they're going to get that politically just because we've had it for the last 50 years, it's a pipe dream. I think it's very unlikely, and I think we'll see more instability and more people migrating to the extreme ends of the right and left of the political spectrum like we have historically here and everywhere else where we see that kind of economy.
I'm reminded listening to you of a wonderful sermon I once heard where an African-American minister in a church got up and she said, as an opening to her sermon, America has three kinds of people: the haves, the have-nots, and the think-they-haves.
Sure.
Was her middle group. And I think in a way you're telling us what's happening to change the haves into the think they haves and the think they haves into a group of self-deluded citizens.
Right, but people's self-delusions can move mountains, quite literally. We have a modern version of it in statistics that's sort of interesting, which you look at aspirational voting patterns. And you'll get a lot of people who go to the voting booth, tends to be more middle-aged plus white males, but not exclusively. They'll go to the voting booth, and they will vote as though they think they would vote if they had made it, which they haven't.
Yeah.
Right? So they're going to have the sort of boss ostensibility in the voting booth. But what that can mean is you can actually have a society that drifts away from the pillars of a large middle class and is pushed there even by the people who are being crushed under the lack of opportunity. And that can go on for decades. I mean, it doesn't mean it will. It's certainly not super stable, but it can last a long, long time.
So instead of voting on the basis of where they actually are, they vote on the basis of where they would prefer to be and imagine they will be and hope to be soon.
Look, I'm not a psychiatrist, and you might get a better answer from somebody in a mental health background. But I think that people are who they imagine they are on many levels, and it's not even altogether appropriate. It's a little bit potentially offensive or arrogant to tell someone who they really are based on your opinion as opposed to theirs. And I don't think those kind of conversations end well or get to cover a whole lot of ground. That being said, both affluent and lower-income Americans routinely vote against their, as I would see, their self-economic interest. And figuring out why is probably a cultural and political story more than an economic story, but that can go on for a long, long time. And indeed it has. And look, I think part of the problem American discussions about inequality have right now is we seem to take as our baseline, our normal, an abnormality. So what's abnormal is to have a big middle class, a lot of opportunity. We had it from the 1930s up to the 1980s. That is historically for the U.S., right, and internationally compared to other countries, anomalous. And what we may or may not want is to reproduce an anomaly, but we think it's sort of the natural state. So if you leave things alone, they'll gyrate back toward there. That was actually a contrived, unusual, historical, and international anomaly, perhaps worthy of rebuilding, but it's a huge effort because it isn't the standard normal baseline that things revert to.
Okay. Last thing, very last question that we have time for, but I'd be interested in how you respond. Do you think that this decline in the incomes, what they can spend, what they can even imagine to spend on, of the American middle class, since it was such an enormous driver of global economic development for much of the last half century, does that then mean that corporations around the world, including American corporations, are fundamentally faced now with a changing market? The United States is becoming less and less an important market, whereas the rest of the world is becoming more and more the focus for growing markets, growing demand, growing market share, and thus the focus of enterprise.
Sure. So I'll start with a quote, which is great, from a guy named Samuel Palmisano, who used to be the CEO of IBM, which has been a leader in globalization. He's retired at this point. But he said, IBM is not an American company. It belongs to no country. We're a true MNE, multinational enterprise. We were born in the United States, and we will not forget that, nor will we forget that there are 150 other relevant countries, and we're not going to prioritize them particularly in any particular order, right? I'm paraphrasing, not exact quote. But, I mean, the idea is I think that's long since upon us here for American and foreign countries. I like to teach the students the following. The United States has approximately 4.5% of the world's population. In any given year, we produce about 20% of the world's GDP. About 70% of our GDP is consumption. So about 14% of all the wealth produced in a year in the world is consumed by the United States. This makes the United States awful important, even though we only have a little bit less than 1 in 20 global residents, right? Less than 5% of the population. So is the United States unimportant? No. Is the United States hugely important? Sure. But if we're doing about 14% of the world's GDP and consumption, that still leaves the other 86% of the world's GDP not from us. Our share has been falling, some years less, other years more. Other folks' shares have been rising. Most of the global GDP growth for the last 20 years has come from the so-called developing world, places like India and China, where together a third of the world's population, or almost a third, resides. So the U.S. position in the world, economically and politically, is in a bit of a decline. Not so much because we're declining, but we're growing much much less quickly than some others. And corporations grow or die, right? And so I think that people are adjusting to new realities that are less American-centric all the time. And the other thing is that big companies in America either live because they adjust to the changing reality of the American middle class, or they die because they don't. To me, that's the story in many ways of a JCPenney or a Sears, right? These companies we grew in this country that became sometimes global, that did very well serving the middle class, literally are serving a dying or shrinking pool of people at this point, and so it hurts them. So I think that the dollar store and I think Coach are where America's at right now. They do a lot better. And I think stores like, to many extent, like a JCPenney or to a Sears, part of the reason these companies are in perennial trouble is their DNA. They grew up to serve a shrinking and deeply distressed population.
Max, thank you very much. Much insight. I appreciate very much your coming.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
In the few moments that we have left to today's program, I want to turn to some of the questions that you have asked me and try to provide a bit of an answer. In one of the topics, and I'm searching my vast trove of papers here to be able to get you the exact numbers, you asked a question about whether it pays for cities and states to subsidize private capitalist ventures. And the question in particular had to do with movies. A number of you have noticed that in your community or in your state or in your city, a feature-length film that you later can go to the movie near you to see was shot, and you were kind of pleased, and maybe you caught a glimpse of an actor or an actress. Does it pay is your question. And the answer, and this was done by a law professor at Pepperdine University in this country, the basic answer is a clear and unambiguous no. And the example that the professor used, and I'm going to repeat here, is The Wolf of Wall Street. Basically, the state of New York, which hosted the filming of that motion picture, provides a 30% cut in taxes to give the incentive to have that done here as opposed to another state or, for that matter, even perhaps another country. And the question is, does it pay? In the long debates and struggles and the public media discussion of these sorts of things that lead up to a decision by a governor or a state legislature to provide such benefits to private motion picture companies, it is widely said by all kinds of people who want this to happen that the state will benefit. And the idea here is as follows, that if you give a cut to a motion picture company, and they bring the actors and actresses and all the technical personnel to your state, in this case New York, New York City, that there will be so much benefit, hotels booked with all the people that need to have places to stay, restaurants doing a bang-up business with all the extra people coming into town to make the film, etc., etc. When you add it all up, all that extra business will pay so much in taxes that the state will actually get more taxes because what it loses in not getting taxes from the film company will be more than made up by all the taxes paid by all the beneficiaries of having that movie made here. Well, mostly that kind of discussion is never tested later on. Nobody actually follows up after the movie is made, most of the time. And by the way, the same applies to a stadium that is funded by public money, built for a football team or a basketball team, or 100 other examples like this. There's very rarely any follow-up study. So I was much taken by Professor Karen from Pepperdine in his blog when he did the work. And he showed in the case of The Wolf of Wall Street, and indeed in his work, he shows it for many motion pictures, that it's not true. And in the case of New York, you might be interested to know that what the state got back in extra taxes for what it lost came out to about 30 cents on the dollar. For every dollar it didn't get by giving a special deal to the motion picture company that made The Wolf of Wall Street, it got back 30 cents. In other words, the people of New York subsidized a private corporation, and it cost them plenty to do so. There were particular beneficiaries, hotels, restaurants, and others in New York who got a benefit. But for the state as a whole, for the taxpayers as a whole, no, it's a losing proposition. The next question is, again, about that topic of manufacturing coming back to the United States. And that's one of the reasons I spent so much time on it at the beginning of this program. But here's a particular question. Does manufacturers' return to the United States, even if it is much less than is hyped, does it at least mean more jobs? And the interesting answer to that is, no, actually, it doesn't. Because increasingly, the jobs that are coming back here have to do with shoring, it's called, I believe the phrase is shoring, bringing production back from a far distant overseas to a closer location because of tax advantages, because of political considerations, because of being worried about disruptions in long distance flows. You know, if you produce in China, the stuff has to come all the way back here. But it turns out that more and more of the manufacturing that is brought closer is also being automated and being transitioned from workers to robots. So in a sense, we have now a complicated global situation. In America, we use largely people at high wages, which means we have two options for our capitalist employers: to go elsewhere where the wages are much lower, or to substitute robots. And we're beginning to see a little bit of a combination nearby, not in the United States, but much nearer, with many more robots, seems to be an optimum solution for an increasing number of corporations. Bottom line, and not a surprise, what is being done and what is being contemplated is driven by corporations, who are in turn driven by the needs to grow, the needs to make profits, the needs to make market share expand, and the needs to take into account, as Max so well told us, where the markets are growing and where they are shrinking. Those are the considerations, and the decisions of corporations are being made to meet those goals, and we live with the results. In an economy in which living with the results and having little or no influence is the norm. And that's the question in the end we all have to consider. Thank you very much for being with me. Thanks again to Max for sharing today's program. This is Economic Update. I'm Richard Wolff. Please remember our websites, rdwolff.com and democracyatwork.info. I will look forward to being with you again next week.
Gonna be my time, baby. Thing gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change, change.